You hear America's Test Kitchen on the radio and maybe have seen us also on public television, but now you can see us live on stage. Join me and test cook Dan Souza for a personal behind-the-scenes tour of our test cooks, our testing process, and our food. We do live taste tests, science experiments, take audience questions, and show exclusive footage of some of our best moments and also our worst disasters, such as the time I almost burned down the set on the Today Show. We have shows coming up in March and April, New York, March 31st, Seattle, April 7th, and San Francisco, April 8th. Just go to our website, which is americastestkitchen.com/events. That's americastestkitchen.com/events for information and tickets. This is Christopher Kimball. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. You can head over to our website, which is atkradio.com. We post our recipes, equipment reviews, taste test results, and also our wine recommendations. Enjoy this week's show. This is America's Test Kitchen from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, and I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. I still remember reading The Jungle, a novel based on real conditions in Chicago slaughterhouses around 1900, and felt very relieved to know that those days are now over. That is until I read a New York Times article entitled The Dead Pit, reported by Michael Moss. It turns out the USDA has been funding an animal research center in Nebraska to boost meat production. This has cost the lives of and inflicted suffering on thousands of animals, from stillborn calves, abandoned lambs, and piglets crushed by their mothers. Michael takes us inside the facility to reveal what the USDA will do to improve the profitability of the meat industry with little or no regard for animal welfare.
As consumers increasingly want and demand meat products that are from animals that are raised as humanely as possible, and grocers and meat producers respond to that demand, this research facility was still going the other direction, coming up with experiments with no oversight that decreased the welfare of animals.
Also on our show today, we take up the challenge of an almost hands-free risotto, and we do a blind tasting of broths. But first, it's time for this week's Test Kitchen Tip. We all know that whipped cream doesn't keep very well. The liquid weeps out of the mixture and eventually loses the air bubbles that have been whipped into it. So to see if we could stabilize this topping, we tried adding everything from marshmallow cream, xanthan gum, and cream of tartar to confectioner sugar, non-fat dry milk powder, and even gelatin. But the best of the bunch turned out to be the last one, gelatin. It kept the cream in perfect condition for a full day. So here's how it works. For 1.5 cups cold cream, sprinkle 1/2 teaspoon unflavored powdered gelatin over 1.5 tablespoons of water in a microwave-safe bowl and let stand for 3 minutes. Then we microwaved in 5-second increments until the gelatin dissolved and liquefied. Whip the cream on medium speed with a little sugar and vanilla until the beaters begin to leave a trail, and then slowly pour in the gelatin mixture. Continue to beat at high speed until soft peaks form. Coming up, we take your calls, but first we head into the test kitchen for this week's kitchen taste test. Jack, how are you?
I'm well, Chris.
Well, we're here in the test kitchen and I'm tasting some sort of broth. They're different colors, though. I find this rather confusing.
These are all low-sodium vegetable broths. I know, it's hard enough to make a good commercial vegetable broth.
How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. Thank you so much.
Well, there are two reasons that you might want to buy this. Number one is for people who are on low-sodium diets. The federal standards for broth to be labeled low-sodium is a maximum of 140 milligrams of sodium per cup of broth. Now, to put that number into context, a lot of conventional packaged broths have 500 or 1,000 milligrams of sodium. At 1,000 milligrams, you're having half of your sodium allotment for the day in one cup of broth. The second reason, even if you're not on a low-sodium diet, is that in recipes where you're reducing down the broth, think Parmesan risotto, you know, it can get really salty if you're using a regular broth. And so there might be reasons to want to use this even if you're not concerned about your sodium intake and you want to keep your food from being overly salty. So we had 5 samples. We tasted them the way you're tasting them, which is just warmed up. We made soup. We made risotto with them. The good news is we found 1 we liked. The bad news is we thought 3 were just downright awful. It's really hard to build flavor when you don't have salt. And the ways that the winner builds flavor are not the most natural ways. As you might imagine, if you have no salt, what do? You need to add something else to distract the person who is tasting it from recognizing that it has little flavor. So anything that you are immediately liking or disliking?
I'm glad I eat meat. Chicken broth is better. The middle one is sort of a beef broth color. The other two look more like chicken broth, clearer. I would say when you taste this, it sucks all of the happiness out of your mouth. It just makes me very depressed eating this. It's very depressing. So I would say that's definitely not in the running. It almost has such an absence of flavor. It leaves a void in your mouth, I would say.
The interesting thing is when we read the labels and looked at the ingredients and then looked at the ratings, it seemed almost the inverse, that the more natural, the more vegetables, the less we liked it. And that the top-rated brands had a couple of common traits. Number one is they all contained yeast extract, sometimes the first ingredient. And yeast extract is basically, it's akin to almost like MSG. It's a flavor booster. It just tricks your taste buds into thinking there's more there than there really is. Second thing is a lot of them add sugar. So it says, cane juice on the ingredient label. That's otherwise known as sugar. Some of them add fat. Just because you're on a low-salt diet doesn't mean you're on a low-fat diet. And so they then add palm oil or other things to give it some viscosity. Some of them add cornstarch so that it has a little bit more body to it. Yeah. Interestingly, our top-rated brand only had two vegetables, and I could bet $1 million that you would never guess the two vegetables that were in our top-rated brand: chicory and garlic.
No, what?
I know, chicory does not make any sense. And it also had a spice, mace, which you almost never use in the kitchen. In fact, several of the brands contained mace. A bit of a mystery as to what that is doing in these.
Well, they obviously got a lot of it cheap. That's probably why. So the three samples, the middle one I already talked about, it looks like beef broth, has no flavor, didn't like it. The end ones, one and three, both look like chicken stock. The third one has some floating miasma of some kind with no flavor. And I thought the flavor was okay. The first one, I thought had a little more depth of flavor to it. So I'd probably pick the first one. One and three are similar. I pick one. The second one was the worst. Third one was okay. I'm going with number one.
Let's see what you picked. You chose the winner. This is actually Edward & Sons. It's low-sodium, not chicken, natural bouillon cube. So they're not, it's a vegetable broth, but they're mimicking chicken, even though it is meatless. We thought this was acceptable.
It's not bad.
It was clearly better than the other options.
The one I really didn't like, number two, was
our lowest rated of the samples. This is More Than Gourmet vegetable
it
culinary
stock.
It
certainly is.
Yeah, it's. We thought there's almost no flavor there whatsoever.
No, as I said, it had so little flavor, it just sucked the flavor out of your mouth. The third one that had floating something was
our runner-up. So we thought this
not
is
bad.
Called Rapunzel. We thought it was recommended with reservations. In a pinch, it was acceptable, but it didn't seem nearly as good as the winner.
So we did have a winner in our low-sodium vegetable stock tasting. It was Edward & Sons low-sodium, not chicken. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. You can find today's show and all the weekly shows at atkradio.com, and also they're posted on iTunes. We also post our weekly recipes, reviews, wine tastings, and taste test results. Now it's time to take some calls, and joining me, of course, is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. How are you?
I'm fabulous. feel fabulous.
Super fine and fabulous. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Wendy.
Hi, Wendy. Where are you calling from?
Myrna, Tennessee.
Oh. Bridget's in heaven. That's all I can say. She would move to Tennessee tonight
I
if
would.
She could.
Yeah.
It is beautiful.
Well, I'll just check out of this call. I'll come back. The two of you are finished.
Well, what can we help you with today, Wendy?
Well, I have two unrelated questions, except for the fact that I keep getting different advice on different sides of my family about
uh-oh.
It.
Uh-oh. Oh, that was the first problem. You asked your family. Never ask your family.
I never ask family, especially not the women. I asked about rice was the first thing. I have a wonderful mother-in-law and a wonderful grandmother, and one says rinse, and one says don't ever rinse it. So are you supposed to rinse rice before you cook it or not?
That's an excellent question. And that's a little bit of an argument in the test kitchen, too. We tend to rinse rice when we want to make something like a pilaf, where you want the grains to be very distinct, because there is some surface starch on that rice. So we'll swish it around and we'll rinse it under water. Now, if you ask me practically if I do that home,
no
I don't. So do you absolutely have to? No, but you will get more distinct grains of rice if you do.
Well, if you make a pilaf, you can take the rice unrinsed, put 2 teaspoons of oil in it, you know, stir it up, heat it in the pan for a minute or two, then add the water and the salt and cook it. And that does a pretty good job of separating the grains. And I think that's why you and I probably don't rinse it.
Right.
A little bit of oil and just stir it for a minute or so in a medium hot pan. Then add the water and the salt, and that'll do a good job.
Oh, good. Well, the second question is subbing out applesauce in certain baked goods. I know nothing replaces butter in that flavor, but if you're trying to be somewhat healthy, when is that okay to do? When is it not? And do you replace all of the oil or half of it?
Please, don't. No, never, never use applesauce
to sub.
No, never. I mean, who would want to eat a brownie or chocolate cake made with applesauce?
I'd rather have a half a brownie.
Yeah. Change the portion, not the ingredient.
Right.
Just don't. Yeah, just don't do it.
Years ago, we made a apple snack cake based on the old applesauce cake, and we ended up adding, I want to say, easily a stick of butter to it.
It was much better.
It was so much better. You know, it had a richer flavor, a richer feel, and applesauce on its own often will make things feel springy and cottony, and, you know, it's a cake.
Can I just ask an historical question? Who came up with the idea, the terrible idea, of saying that applesauce is a substitute for butter? Was this the Moosewood cookbook in the 1970s?
I think it was the Grinch.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought of this? It must have been the applesauce board. You know?
They were like, oh, this will work out well.
Oh, applesauce. I mean, this is probably, I'm really going out there, but was somebody thinking, oh, apple butter, which is similar to applesauce, is a butter?
I don't think they were thinking, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think the answer is no.
Just skip it, change the portion.
Change the portion, exactly. Eat something else.
And enjoy it.
Yeah, life's too short for applesauce instead of butter. Doesn't do it.
Okay, well, thank y'all very much. I appreciate it.
You take care.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
My name is Kate McKinley.
Can we help you?
I do a lot of mass-produced baking. And what that means is, like, I'll take a recipe that would make, like, 4 little loaves of banana bread and try to make 12. And the recipes that I'm talking about are kind of dunked with fruit. But that's not the culprit, because when you make a single batch, they turn out beautifully. It's when you double or triple them. And with every progression, they get denser and flatter and heavier and more inedible. You know, sometimes I get away with doubling, but never can get away with tripling. So what I've had to end up doing is, like, I'll mix all the wet ingredients, I'll triple the wet ingredients, and then I'll have 3 separate containers of the dry ingredients. And then I'll, like, weigh out the wet ingredients into 3 bowls and then combine them separately. And that way it works. But is there a trick to doubling or tripling recipes, especially recipes that, you know, are kind of dense with wet ingredients like apples or bananas or pumpkin?
I think the problem is that, as Bridget will tell you, doubling or tripling baking recipes, if you like to live on the edge in a culinary way, that would be about as risky as it gets, right?
Baking, yes. I mean, you know, you can double a chili recipe pretty much without any effect. But once you start doubling baking recipes, doubling, as you mentioned, you can probably get away with it. Tripling is just crazy talk, because it's...
I've done it.
It usually comes down to the leavener. And I'll tell you what, professional bakers, when they take a published recipe and they bring it into the commercial kitchen, they have to either make it only in double batches, one after another, or they have to re-engineer the recipe. And it's usually the leavener that's the culprit, because you can probably get away with doubling, but tripling the leavener, it usually takes progressively less leavener every time that you double or triple a batch, especially baking soda. You want to use less and less, because it can really give an off flavor to baked goods. And if you're using too much leavener, the other thing is it will start to rise and then collapse, and you'll get that really dense cake. So it's basically over-leavened at that point.
And what about mixing, too? She said that when she did it in 3 separate batches, then combined them, it worked.
Right.
That's because the mixing was done properly with a smaller batch, right?
That's right. It's hard to mix really big batches of anything, but, you know, especially batters and really thick batters sufficiently. You're either going to under-mix it, and you're not going to get enough structure, Or conversely, you're going to think, oh, I've really got to mix the heck out of this. You're going to produce too much gluten, and then you'll get a really squat cake. So it's finding that perfect in-between mixing method. And then the other thing, I'm assuming that when you double or triple these, you're baking them still in individual pans?
Correct.
Okay, well, that's good. I would cut back on the leavener just a bit and doubling them at the most.
So there's no magic solution, except for you think that if you re-engineer a recipe, you would, like, not triple the leavener. You'd 1.5 the leavener?
Probably.
Or two times.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for answering.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This is America's Test Kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball here with our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster. Give us a call anytime at 855-34-COOKS. One more time, 855-34-COOKS. Or email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for another call.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Zach from Christiansburg, Virginia.
How are you doing, Zach?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing well. And is there something we can help you with today?
Yeah, so a few months ago, I bought an Aero Garden, which is the indoor hydroponic growing kit for dummies, basically, with the goal of growing herbs year-round. And I've done pretty well, but I have an overabundance of oregano that's beginning to take over our kitchen. So I was wondering what kind of uses there are for fresh oregano besides pizza sauce, because I think we've eaten about all we can eat.
Yeah, oregano is one of those herbs that takes over, like mint.
Yeah.
What else is doing well in your indoor garden? I'm just curious.
We got a tall basil, and we've got a whole lot of dill, but the Aero Garden tarragon turned out to be, I think, Russian tarragon, which I didn't know this at the time, but apparently it doesn't have any flavor.
Yeah, French tarragon has a lot more flavor.
You can apparently only grow that through cutting. The thyme died from mold, I'm sad to say.
Well,
I think oregano is one of the few herbs that actually you can't... It's very strong.
It's very distinct.
Yeah. I mean, if you have, you said dill, well, you can use that in large quantities. Uh-huh. Tarragon, you use large quantities. Basil, you use large quantities. But you can't really make a pesto out of oregano.
It's like rosemary.
Yeah, it's too strong.
Right.
How about sacrificing it to the gods and planting something else?
Yeah, I could do that too. I only have 7 spots to grow things.
Well, I mean, oregano is one of those things if you're coating, you know, chicken or pork cutlets, something like that. I'm thinking of things like chicken salad, egg salad. It's great in that.
But it sounds like he has 3-year inventory of oregano.
Well, the other thing is fresh oregano actually freezes pretty well. So you can take a few, freeze them, and put them into the whole sprig and all into your spaghetti sauce, something like that, and then give the rest away and plant something else.
I've seen it in chili recipes sometimes too, but they always call for dried. Is there any reason dried is preferred?
Dried's preferred because it's usually used in a rub, and it's used in a rub, so it's easier for it to, you know, to spread it all over. But if you don't use it in the rub and you put it in the sauce, you'll still get some really nice oregano
flavor.
That's
a good idea. You could do a barbecue rub and make one that's based on oregano. Do a Ziploc bag or something, and that'll keep quite a long time.
Yep.
So I would dry the oregano first. It does dry pretty well, unlike basil or something.
In a low oven or something like that?
You can just hang it.
Yep.
And make a rub out of it, and then that rub will keep a long time. That would be the best thing to do with it, probably. Yep. And oregano would be good in certain kinds of barbecue rubs.
Yep, and chili. Yeah.
Is there anything I should grow instead if I decide to dry it and get rid of it?
I think tarragon is the least used, best herb that almost nobody uses.
I agree with
it
that.
Has a wonderful flavor, and it's good in so many things. I would definitely grow a lot of that. Dill's great.
Savory is another one that people don't use, and it's so good.
Summer savory is very good. I mean, the problem is rosemary's too strong, and you rarely use it. I wouldn't use that.
I mean, one of the most useful things to have in your kitchen, though, is thyme, because so many recipes call for it. So I would maybe give that a try again.
Yeah. I briefly grew shareable, too, but pretty much nobody calls for shareable.
And something you'll never be able to get rid of is chives. You can definitely grow those anywhere.
Well, there are a lot of recipes, though, salads and bean salads, rice salads, they use a handful of herbs. That's a typical cooking these days. So sometimes use a quarter cup or a half a cup of some of these things. And so those kinds of herbs you could actually use quite a lot of.
Yep.
But they can't be really strong.
Okay.
There you go.
The idea.
Send us some rub when you make it.
All right, will do.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye.
If you do have a question, any kind of question, give us a ring, 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. Or simply email us at questions@atkradio.com. Coming up a bit later, I speak with Michael Moss, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times, about his recent article called The Dead Pit. In 1971, I hitchhiked down through Eastern Europe with my college roommate, and we ended up in Istanbul, where I spent 2 glorious weeks eating street food, playing backgammon, and drinking very sweet tea. The food was bright, sensual, and bold, and unlike melting pot European cuisines, the cooking techniques were refreshingly simple, yet the combination of ingredients and flavors was much more complex. Years later, I discovered that this is also true of the other cuisines of the Mediterranean, from the foods of Spain, Tunisia, and Greece to southern France. They offer brighter, fresher solutions for everyday cooking. So, if you like Mediterranean cooking, you might want to check out The Everyday Gourmet, The Joy of Mediterranean Cooking, taught by Chef Bill Briwa from the Culinary Institute of America and produced by a company called Great Courses. You'll get a great introduction to street food, pick up ideas and recipes for seafood from the Riviera, and become familiar with many of the dishes from the Eastern Mediterranean, Turkey to Spain, and then all the way to Morocco. Great Courses offers courses in over 500 subjects, including history, art and music, science, and more. You can watch these courses with online downloads, streaming via their apps, or on DVDs, even CDs. Great Courses has a special offer for America's Test Kitchen listeners. Order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including The Everyday Gourmet, The Joy of Mediterranean Cooking, and get up to 80% off the original price. But this offer will only be available for a limited time. So don't wait. Go to thegreatcourses.com/kitchen, thegreatcourses.com/kitchen. One more time, don't forget, it's thegreatcourses.com/kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Breeding used to be a natural process. Select two animals of the same species, each of which with desirable characteristics, and breed them to produce a superior specimen. But with the advent of DNA and genetics, this has become a more scientific process. Today, the USDA is funding an animal research center in Nebraska that has one very clear goal: to boost meat production through more offspring and hardier stock that can withstand brutal winter conditions. These experiments have shocked veterinarians as well as ranchers, folks who generally care deeply about the health and welfare of their animals. What used to be natural has become unnatural. I began my interview with author Michael Moss, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times, by asking him to describe the dead pit, which was also the title of his article.
The dead pit is a vast excavation at this facility in the middle of Nebraska, owned by the federal government, run by the Department of Agriculture, where animals that have died after experimentation are buried in the ground.
So this place is called the United States Meat Animal Research Center?
Yes, meat animal, referring to pigs, cows, and sheep that they experiment on for the benefit of the meat industry.
And so they're looking to create more offspring, right? And they're also looking at ways to save money. So exactly what are some of the experiments they've been running?
Yeah, and you hit it exactly. Their overarching goal is to increase production and lower costs for the industry. With cows, one of their longest running experiments was aimed at creating cows that have twins instead of single calves, on the notion that at the end of weaning, when the cattle go to the slaughterhouse, there'll be more weight on the hoof and thus more profit. Typically, cows naturally will have in the order of 2 or 3% calves that are twins. This place, through years and years of selective breeding and matching with bulls that had a tendency toward twins, raised that up to 55%. So 55 out of every 100 calves were twins at the facility. That was the good news. The bad news was that the mortality rate of the twins was more than 4 times that of single calves. Their legs would get tangled up in the birthing canal. They would get born and the mother would ignore one of the two and it would starve to death. The scientists at the center put huge amounts of labor into saving the twins. But all of those years while they were building up their herd, and we're talking 900 cows just for this project alone, ranchers were appalled because they put every ounce of effort that they have into saving their animals. I was really struck by how incredibly caring your typical rancher is when it comes to their animals. And so to them, this whole concept of twinning was to many of them, I should say, was appalling and unacceptable. And yet this center just pushed on and on and on.
So, obvious question. You have a government agency which is supposed to serve the commercial rancher doing something the commercial rancher doesn't want them to do, right?
That was one of the surprising things to me. Look, I mean, I've, you know, story after story I've done on the Department of Agriculture has sort of shown that when it comes to, you know, conflicts with consumers, their efforts are largely on behalf of industry. And when push comes to shove, they side with industry, whether it's food safety issues or whether it's nutritional standards, what have you. But in this case, I was really amazed at how, in so many ways, they weren't even, didn't seem to be serving the industry that they claimed and hoped to serve. And I think the reason for that, Chris, is that they sort of lost touch with reality. And you know, I sort of write in the piece how, in recent years, as consumers increasingly want and demand, you know, meat products that are from animals that are raised as humanely as possible, and grocers and meat producers respond to that demand, this research facility was still going the other direction, coming up with experiments with no oversight that decreased the welfare of animals. So, for example, they were weaning piglets at 10 days from their mothers in order to put them on a drink that would create a leaner, more meatier pig, when grocers like Whole Foods are pushing their suppliers to go to 56 days of weaning in order to minimize the trauma and health effects of early weaning.
So it sounds like a lot of the ranchers didn't really know what was going on there. Two, the USDA, many people may not have known. They were just operating totally out in a different universe?
The center has this reputation of having scientists who have the resources and the wherewithal to experiment on issues that the industry itself can't do. And one of the things that the industry likes the most about this center is sort of their genetics. I mean, they have helped sort of decode the cow so that particular traits can be dialed in and cow breeding can become a lot more sophisticated than just sort of selecting a purebred or what have you. But beyond that, I think that much of the meat industry, and especially sort of smaller ranchers, were totally clueless about what the center was up to.
I have to stop for a second and ask the philosophical, the obvious philosophical question, which Peter Singer, who wrote Animal Liberation in the 1970s, I think also talked about. So is intelligence of the mammal the yardstick for measuring moral issues like suffering? That is, the dumber the animal, the more we can let them suffer? I mean, how does that work?
I put that question to some of the scientists there, and I think partly what we're seeing here is a throwback to the days when a lot of people felt that farm animals didn't feel pain. But increasingly, people have become sensitive to the fact that cows and pigs and sheep feel pain. And, you know, I put that question to ranchers and some of the scientists who have objected to some of the experimentation going on at the center. And their attitude is, look, you know, on whatever level you want to argue, morally, ethically, religiously, our attitude is that, yes, we are going to eat these animals. We're putting them on earth for our benefit. And that behooves us, in fact, to do everything we can to give them the best possible life that they possibly can have until we kill them and eat them.
So who gets to make this decision?
You know, at this point, the center has been making the decisions about what experiments to do and how to run its experiments with really very minimal oversight from Washington, the Department of Agriculture there, except kind of on the broader issues of, is this really the way we want to go? And I think that's one of the responses I've heard to the piece, which is, where is the Department of Agriculture on research for animal pain, for animal welfare, for animals that sort of meet this growing consumer demand for meat that is from animals that are well cared for.
Let me ask you this. Over time, we've realized that animals are not dumb. Many animals are actually quite intelligent, not just dogs and cats, dolphins, birds, etc. Eventually, as research shows that there is a lot of intelligence there, does that change a whole relationship with the animal world?
I think it totally does. I mean, again, you know, if you're a meat eater and if you're actually thinking about that meat that you're eating, you can't help but know that that's an intelligent animal that you are consuming. But I sort of think what happens is that kind of the, you know, the taste and the allure of meat kind of overcomes us. And I know this is true with me, and I know it's true with some of my friends, that you kind of, you're at the dinner table and you're cutting into that steak, and just kind of something happens where you stop thinking about the animal. And, you know, and also, it's really amazing to me how little we really know about the agriculture system in this country. I had no idea that there's this phenomena called overlay or crushing with pigs, in which the sow inadvertently, because of the physical environment that she's in or the increasing number of piglets that she's been bred to have, lays down and crushes her piglets every year. The estimate I got from the industry, and the USDA officials confirmed this, 10 million piglets get crushed in this way by their mothers. And that cannot be an easy death. I had no idea that that was part of the hidden price of the pork that we eat.
Let's talk about you. So I'm not an investigative reporter. You are. You want to do this story. How do you get inside a place like this research center to report when I'm sure they probably wouldn't welcome you in the front door?
It was frustrating. They declined my request to interview the director. Many of the people there, while many defended their work, others declined to speak with me. There were people inside who did agree to speak. There was a significant tension at this center between kind of the scientists who were purely animal scientists doing these experiments, and then the few of those who also had veterinarian degrees, because they take an oath to protect the animals, much like doctors take an oath to protect humans. And some of those veterinarians with animal science degrees helped me understand what was going on at the center. And on Mother's Day last year, I did manage to get inside the locked facility and see for myself the Easy Care lambing operation, when on a typical weekend, 25 dead lambs were brought in from the pasture and opened up to determine the cause of their death. And it was a stunning situation. I took the photographs. There are videos on the Times website that your listeners can look at as well.
Do you think it's possible a generation from now that there will be an animal bill of rights that will be applied to any commercial application?
Well, we already kind of have that in the form, in terms of research, in terms of the Animal Welfare Act, which was passed back in 1966, 2 years after this center was opened up, to protect animals that were used in laboratory experiments. What I didn't know, though, is that that act was passed in response to public concerns over cats and dogs used in experimentation for medical research, etc., and that there was a specific exemption granted to research on farm animals for agricultural purposes. Just last week, there was legislation introduced in both houses of Congress that would end that loophole and subject researchers experimenting on farm animals to the same sort of basic standards that are applied to cats and dogs. And one of the issues of this place is that, you know, many universities that do research have oversight. They have external oversight. They have people coming in to sort of look at their experimentation to see if it's valid, to see if everything possible to minimize pain and suffering of the animals used in that experimentation. This center does not have that sort of external, you know, institutional animal use and care effort looking at its experimentation.
Last question. Any point in this whole process where you changed from seeing what you saw?
Boy, you know, it was the day on Mother's Day when I managed to get inside the facility and got into the one of the pastures where they're doing this quote-unquote easy care lambing and seeing and filming this one lamb that had been abandoned by its mother. The storm was approaching. It was bleeding. You can see this video on the Times website. Totally helpless, totally abandoned, you know, essentially a walking dead lamb who more likely or not would be dead the next day, knowing that there was nobody there intending to rescue that. And there is nothing cuter than a newborn lamb. And it's why, you know, we give little lamb dolls to our kids. But that was a moment that spoke to me most deeply in the reporting.
Facts and statistics cannot fully convey the extent of animal suffering, but let me give this a try. The Animal Research Center has processed 580,000 animals since 1985, 6,500 of which have starved. Pigs are giving birth to 14 piglets instead of 8, and this results in many of them being crushed to death by their mothers. Statistically, 10% of young lambs die after birth, but at this USDA facility, that percentage is close to 30%. Finally, and most telling, the Animal Welfare Act of 1966 exempts farm animals used in research to benefit agriculture. These animal experiments will not cure cancer. They will perhaps simply put more meat on the table per dollar invested. Michael Moss and others ask, is this suffering worth it? Unfortunately, it's a question that should never have to be asked. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up after the break, as we do every week, we answer your cooking questions, we taste test wine, and we learn how to make risotto without all the stirring. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Coming up, as we do every week, we answer your cooking questions, so give us a ring. 855-34-COOKS. That's 855-34-COOKS. But now it's time to head into the Test Kitchen for this week's wine tasting. Stephen, how are you?
Good, Chris.
We're here in our little wine corner in the Test Kitchen, yep. And obviously we're talking about white wines today.
Yep, we've got three beautiful little white wines to taste, and these probably are wines that I'm guessing will be unfamiliar to you, so this will be a kind of introduction.
That would not be hard.
But by way of introduction, Chris, let me ask you a question that I like to ask folks who come to the tasting table in the wine shop where I work, and that is, how many different kinds of grapes do you think wine is more or less regularly made from in the whole world?
I know my answer would be wrong because you love to ask me questions I don't know the answer to. I once read in some wine encyclopedia there were 13 major grapes in the world. And the way you're looking at me, I just...
Well, this book must have been published by the Gallo Group or something like
that. Probably. Slightly more than that, I would guess.
There may only be 13, you know, grapes that are important in industrial level winemaking in the United States or something. But the fact is that there are just hundreds of grapes that really good wine is made from every day, all over the world. And we only focus on a really tiny subsection of them. So I thought maybe today we'd do a little work and kind of expand your knowledge. I've just brought along three that I particularly like, that I think people ought to know more about. They're all from central Italy, slightly northern Italy. Three white wines. The first one is, the grape variety is Garganaga. It's a hard one to say, Garganaga. And this is an important grape in the Soave region in the Veneto in Italy. So why don't you have a sip at that?
So I understand. If there are hundreds of grape varieties, you're picking these three because of all the ones I don't know, which are most of them. These are three I really should know?
Well, because in 7 minutes, there's a limit to the number of grapes we can cover. And three seem like a good number. And these are grapes that really interest me, and I think people really ought to know about.
Boy, this is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So Soave is typically a blend of white grapes, and one of the important grapes in making Soave is something called Trebbiano, but the really quality grape in this part of the world is the one that this is made from. This is 100% Garganaga, It has a lovely broad feel, almost a honeyed kind of note to it. It's really satisfying, crisp.
But it also has good minerality to it. It's got a lot of structure, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is one of the things that characterizes white wine from central Italy, is that it does have beautiful fruit, but it really gives you a lot of mineral interest. It often has a savory side, not just a fruity side. And this is one of the things that makes them really great at the table.
And number two is?
Wine number two is a grape called Greco. So you might imagine that this gets its name because it was introduced by the Greeks originally to the Italian peninsula. And, you know, we should remember that the Romans were not wine drinkers originally. This was a refinement that they learned from the Greeks who originally planted vines.
Well, they stole everything from the Greeks.
They stole architecture and poetry and pretty much everything, including a lot of wine grapes. And Greco is one.
That's a very unusual wine. It has... I don't know what the flavor is, a little avocado or something? Mm-hmm. It has an unusual vegetal flavor there, subtle, but it's quite nice.
Often the way that this wine is described is it has something like an almond or maybe lime profile. Mm-hmm. And again, the mineral element that makes it very, very interesting.
Lovely wine. And now the third wine is what grape?
Fiano. So this is a Fiano di Avellino, the Fiano that's made in the vineyards around the village of Avellino, where the best Fiano comes from. Mm-hmm. All the vineyards here are at some significant amount of elevation. How about that?
It's a little softer than the other two, a little less mineral. It almost is a little sparkly in a way. It seems more softer and more refined wine. It's very nice.
Well, Chris, this is a wine that people often describe as having sort of peachy or maybe stone fruit qualities. It often takes on a kind of a smoky note with a certain amount of age. But again, just really beautifully balanced, nicely poised, good acidity makes it very, very nice at the table. And I think you'll agree, these wines may come from under-the-radar grapes, but there's nothing strange or freaky about them. In fact, they're really delicious.
So two things. Name the grapes one more time.
Right. So we started out with a Soave from the Veneto, and the grape here is Garganega. It's 100% Garganega. The second wine, the Greco di Tufo, 100% Greco. And the third wine, the Fiano di Avellino, 100% Fiano.
My other question is pecuniary.
Yes.
So if I go to in a restaurant or if I go to a store, are these going to be, the value is going to be better because they're under the radar? I'm getting more for my money or not?
Well, of course, part of the problem with these under the radar wines is that they often come from rather small production operations. So these wines are between $20 and $25 typically. They never get very expensive, which is nice. So far as I know, you can't buy a $100 Fiano. Or Greco. So really good value from that point of view, I think.
Stephen, thank you. And by the way, if you're like me, I've never heard of these grapes. These are wines I'm definitely going to look for. If you'd like to look for them, go to our website, atkradio.com. There's a link there, and Stephen has all the information about the specific bottles I tasted today.
You're listening to America's Test Kitchen. Right now it's time to take calls. And joining me, of course, is our culinary expert, Bridget Lancaster.
Hello, Chris.
You ready to take calls?
Sure.
Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
Hey, Chris. My name's Omar. I'm calling from Toronto, Ontario.
What can we help you with today?
I have a question for you guys. I like making steak a lot at home, and I follow your recipe. But I always end up with a lot of smoke in my house because I try to get my cast iron pan as hot as possible. And then the oil starts smoking a lot. I'm trying to do two batches of steaks. So I'm trying to figure out if there's a better way of getting the oil temperature just hot enough to get the steak done properly, but not have my fire alarm go off.
Do you preheat the skillet dry or with oil in it?
I started doing it with oil in it.
That's good.
That's the right answer.
Just put like a tablespoon in, and when it just starts to smoke, then the steaks can go in, which is about 450 degrees. Two other things that might be helpful. Make sure the steaks are really dry on the outside before you put them in. And especially if you have a thicker steak, I would start it in an oven, 275 oven, and get the internal temperature up to about 90 degrees, 90, 95, and then finish them in the cast iron skillet just a couple minutes aside. It'll cut down your stovetop cooking time, and you will get a much better steak. You get a better texture and definitely a better flavor. It's almost like turbocharging dry aging.
Yeah.
It takes about 15 minutes in the oven. And if you have the time, take the steaks out, salt them well on both sides, let them sit on a cooling rack for about an hour first, then put them in the oven, and then finish in the pan. And that'll cut down on the smoke, but you also get a much better steak. What kind of oil are you using, by the way?
Oh, just regular vegetable oil.
You might try like peanut oil, which has a higher smoke point, but canola oil's fine too. Just don't use olive oil or something.
You mentioned you'd like to do the steaks in batches. I would actually get rid of the oil from the first batch after you take the steaks out, and then put more oil into your pan and reheat that until it's just smoking. And it shouldn't take very long because cast iron really holds on to that heat. The oil, the more you use it, the more you heat it, the more it breaks down, and it will start to smoke earlier and earlier. So if you're going to go ahead and sear it in two batches, then I would use clean oil for each batch.
Okay, I'll definitely give those things a shot.
All right.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Take care. Welcome to America's Test Kitchen. Who's calling?
This is Debbie from Los Angeles.
How can we help you?
So I have a question about sifting flour and dry ingredients. I was at my parents' house recently, and my mother was making pancakes from a recipe that I had shared with her. And I noticed she was sifting her flour, and I know that definitely wasn't called for in the recipe, and I was wondering if that's something I should be doing. I don't think I've sifted anything in about 20 years.
The answer is no, you don't have to sift flour. And if you did sift flour, make sure you weigh it first or measure it first, because when you sift it, you're going to get a much less flour per volume. That is, if you took a cup of flour, unsifted, it'll weigh 5 ounces, and a cup of sifted flour weigh 4 ounces.
Right, much loftier.
So it would really mess up a recipe if you didn't measure first. But the only time I would sift is I was doing like a Genoise, like a French sponge cake or something, and you need to get the dry ingredients perfectly layered on top of the wet ingredients to fold them in. But otherwise, I would never sift either. I mean, yeah. Bridget, what about you?
No, I agree. Sifting, I think, you know, was probably catching any larger, coarser pieces of grain back when the producers weren't able to mill so fine on, you know, such a large scale as they do today. You know, a whisk will pretty much aerate flour if that's what you're looking for. You don't usually need to sift. The only thing I can think of that we've sifted in a long time was we sifted oat flour to make sure that there were any large particles were left behind.
But look at the recipe. If a recipe says 1 cup flour, comma, sifted, you'd measure and then sift.
Or don't sift.
But if it says 1 cup sifted flour,
you would probably want to sift.
Then you'd have to sift into the measuring cup or whatever you're using, because that would be a very different weight measurement. Yeah.
I think she sifted before she measured, thinking it would give her a more accurate measurement.
No.
But you're saying exactly the opposite.
She had 20% less flour as a result of sifting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. How did the pancakes turn out, though?
I think they turned out just fine, so it didn't ruin anything. But I didn't know if I needed to go out and buy myself a sifter.
Probably got lighter pancakes.
Yeah.
Or thinner, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
take care.
Bye-bye.
Good question.
Very good question. To sift or not to sift?
Whether in the mind's eye, it is nobler to sift the flour.
Oh, please.
This is America's Test Kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball. Give us a ring anytime at 855-34-COOKS or try 855-342-6657 or email us at questions@atkradio.com. Now it's time for this week's recipe, hands-free risotto. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris.
So this week's recipe challenge was a no-stir risotto, which I think is the holy grail of at least the Italian-American kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just go through the concept of risotto and why it needs to be stirred.
Okay. So risotto is a very interesting rice dish because we actually want to use the starch in the rice. We want it to come out and create a really velvety sauce. So what the stirring normally does is it agitates the grains of rice. So as they swell, absorb water, starch granules come out, and we knock that out of the rice and into the surrounding liquid. So you start out with water or broth, and what you end up with is a really velvety, smooth sauce in the end. So it's traditionally been stirred for the entire time you're cooking it. We found recipes that start to try to eliminate that. So they do a boil in the beginning and then less stirring at the end. So something like maybe 12 minutes of boiling and then 9 minutes of stirring, which is better, but we still wanted to get even less. We wanted to get down to just a couple of minutes of stirring at the end if we could.
So why do you think there's any chance you could eliminate most of the stirring? I mean, what did you test?
So, Chris, what we found pretty early on is we could actually mimic stirring by adding more water or broth at once in the very beginning as opposed to in increments and bring it to a full boil. Now, boil is pretty violent, so it really agitates the rice around and knocks a lot of those starch granules off.
But I would think that would help, but ultimately stirring with a spoon is going to do more work of releasing starch than just boiling, right?
Well, it's true, Chris, but you also have to think about the fact that you're starting with raw rice in the beginning, and there's not a lot of starch coming off. Uh-huh. So stirring early on doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You really need to do it at the
end. And so we still have a period where we stir. We cook for 19 minutes covered in a Dutch oven, and then we take the lid off and we stir for the final 3 minutes. So we really get most of that creaminess right at the end.
And how much rice and how much liquid?
Chris, we're using 5 cups of chicken broth, low sodium because it gets concentrated down, and 2 cups of arborio rice.
Just so I'm clear, so exactly how does this work?
So, Chris, the way we start is pretty traditional. We have some butter in our Dutch oven, and we soften some aromatics. We have onion and garlic for background flavor. We then add the rice and toast it in the oil until it gets a little translucent on the outside. Add our wine. Once that's absorbed, then we add in 5 cups of our broth mixture, and we simmer with the lid on for 19 minutes. So that's really that violent process in the beginning.
And this is on the stovetop?
This is all on the stovetop. So after that 19 minutes is up, Chris, we take the lid off, we stir in a little bit more broth, about 3/4 cup, and then we do our stirring for about 3 minutes. It gets really nice and creamy. And finally, we finish with butter, some chives and parsley, and a little bit of lemon juice.
You have some here, and I'm more than a little suspicious.
I hear that in your voice.
Yeah. You know, Marcella probably wouldn't have agreed with you. Even Lydia Bastianich might have a thing to say about
this.
That's
true.
So let's take a taste. Well, it certainly looks creamy. It looks creamy, and it is, in fact, creamy. So maybe I should invite Lydia to the kitchen. You can make her risotto.
Yeah, let's schedule that for a little later.
So there we have it. This week's recipe challenge was an almost hands-free, no-stir risotto, and you ended up for 2 or 3 minutes at the end giving it a stir. But there you have it, really creamy risotto with almost none of the work. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to America's Test Kitchen. If you want to listen to more of our shows, or if you missed any of today's show, go to atkradio.com, where you can also sign up for a monthly e-newsletter. We also post our recipes, taste test results, and kitchen equipment reviews. You can also email us anytime at questions@atkradio.com. This week, I spoke to Michael Moss about experimentation on America's livestock, and I did have a final thought. Have you ever noticed that some things just never seem to change? We talk endlessly about the dangers of junk foods, yet supermarkets are still full of quote-unquote natural, pure-squeezed, whole-grain, organic, and free-range products that are guaranteed to mislead. We raise and slaughter animals under sometimes horrifying conditions, even after endless exposés and investigations. And of course, as consumers, we almost always vote with our pocketbooks, not our hearts, purchasing the cheapest bit of produce or meat, regardless of origin or practice. And when someone like me stands up and points out the obvious, we come across as both preachy and annoying. So perhaps I should chill and take the long view. Things do change over generations and sometimes over centuries. I would just like to live long enough to experience the joys of a better future. America's Test Kitchen is produced by America's Test Kitchen Productions in association with WGBH. Our executive producer is Melissa Baldino. Our co-executive producer is Stephanie Stender. Associate producer, Caitlin Hammond. Our senior audio engineer is Alan Mattis. Segment editing by Melissa Allison with Sydney Lewis and Vicki Merrick. Post-production by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help by Debbie Paddock. Theme music by the Mahotel of Queens. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. America's Test Kitchen Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.